This is WMNF Tampa. Time for Talking Animals.
Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and this is a recorded version of Talking Animals, once again produced remotely at the corporate headquarters in Jupiter Farms, Florida. Today, I will feature two interviews I recorded in recent days. The first, which I'll air in just a moment, is with Jessica Jansen, East Coast Coordinator of Animal Place's Food for Thought program. Animal Place is a farm animal sanctuary in Northern California, one of the country's oldest and largest. Food for Thought is its ongoing campaign designed to help animal welfare, social justice, and environmental organizations to adopt animal and earth-friendly menu policies for their events. If at first glance this might initially seem like an esoteric issue or inside baseball, it may be helpful to consider the disconnect, the cognitive dissonance, really, inherent in an animal welfare or rescue organization offering hot dogs and burgers at its fundraiser or adoption event, or environmental or climate change-minded operations serving chicken at its award banquet. As activists or volunteers or even just as financial donors, do we really want to support organizations that are important to us engaging in such a seriously mixed message or such mixed behavior? One of the reasons I wanted to speak with Jessica and highlight Food for Thought is that an important part of the program is helping organizations transition to adopting plant-based menu policy, with that help extending to assisting them in seeking food donations from various companies, to sometimes providing grants to help underwrite events embracing the plant-based menu policies, even offering specific menu ideas for events ranging from small receptions to major banquets. We'll hear all about that and more when I air my interview with Jessica Jansen in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Also, off topic, but I wanted to mention that I recently conducted an interview with Temple Grandin as part of a new series called Paramount Conversations, presented by the historic Paramount Theater in Austin, where I've interviewed Dr. Grandin on stage a couple of times in recent years. Because it happened during quarantine, this interview was conducted by Zoom, what else, and the ostensible focus was her recommendations for how families with a member on the autism spectrum might better cope with the conditions of the COVID-19 quarantine. But we covered other subjects too. But part of what makes this off-topic is that we did not discuss anything animal-related. Still, it was a good conversation, and if you're interested in checking it out, simply search Paramount Theater Austin, and this conversation will be prominently displayed on the website that pops up. Meanwhile, later in today's program, I'll air another interview I recorded recently, this one with Dara Eckhart, the CEO of Friends of Strays, a longtime St. Petersburg-based shelter dedicated to the care and adoption of homeless pets. Eckhart came to Friends of Strays less than 4 years ago, but in that short time, she has significantly improved and reinvigorated the organization. We'll hear about some of the changes she's implemented, some new and recent developments, and how COVID-19 has affected Friends of Strays' operation. That'll be a bit later in today's show. Right now, in an interview recorded Friday about the Food for Thought program, this is Jessica Jansen on Talking Animals on WMNF. Thanks for joining us on the show, Jessica.
Thank you so much for having me, Duncan. I appreciate it.
For sure. So Food for Thought is a program conceived and started by Animal Place. So for those listening who may not be familiar, I'd like to ask you first to provide maybe a thumbnail sketch of Animal Place. Tell us a little bit about it and the work it otherwise does.
Yeah, so Animal Place is a farmed animal sanctuary located in Grass Valley, California. And it was started back in 1989, and it was started by Kim Sterla, who is the founder. And the Food for Thought campaign is a campaign that is part of Animal Place's campaign. And we work with shelters, rescue groups, environmental, wildlife, and social justice groups to adopt many policies that are animal, environment, and human friendly.
Okay, we'll delve into that for sure in a moment, but just another moment or two on Animal Place. I mean, Grass Valley is in Northern California, not far from Sacramento. I only happen to know that because I went to school in Davis. But yeah, the Animal Place has been around some 30 plus years and been doing great work, and is a farm sanctuary that a lot of people know about, but some people maybe just don't recognize it as readily as some other farm sanctuaries. So it's good to be able to mention a bit more about that before we get into food for thought. In fact, I assume probably like all sanctuaries and similar facilities these days that the COVID-19 impact at Animal Place has been considerable. How are the animals doing, and what about the human animals?
They're doing great, actually. Even though we are close to the public currently,
yeah,
we just had a fantastic rescue. We actually flew 1,000 chickens, I believe from Iowa back to California to have home at the sanctuary until they can be adopted out. So we are still rescuing animals. We are practicing social distancing and being safe as possible, but all the caretakers are still coming into work and still providing quality care and lots of love to all of our residents.
Yeah, and one of the reasons I wanted to spend another moment on Animal Place is that was a national story, the rescue of the 1,000 chickens. So, I mean, it's great that Animal Place was able to step right up and do that, and again have the facilities for it and the expertise and experience to know exactly how to handle something that was with that many animals. That's a pretty serious, ambitious undertaking.
Yeah, we're very proud of the sanctuary. We're very proud of the people who volunteer and work there, for the donor who provided the funds to transport those chickens. It's a wonderful sanctuary, and I can say I'm very proud to work for the organization.
On the other hand, maybe, what's your sense of fundraising and other things at Animal Place, given the considerable limitations of COVID-19?
It's hard for me to comment on how the sanctuary is raising funds right now because I don't actually have any part of that work.
Right.
I can say that as far as the campaign is concerned, we are funded by a very generous donor, so we are still able to offer grants to organizations that want to host a vegan event or want to adopt a vegan menu policy. So we're very fortunate as a campaign to still have those funds.
That's great. All right, well, we will definitely circle back to that. So, in fact, before we really do get more seriously into food for thought, let's look at really the problem that is the underpinning of food for thought. So animal welfare organizations, social justice and environmental organizations, sanctuary shelters, rescues, and others often serve animals as food at their fundraisers, their fairs, their festivals, and other events. So I'm thinking about, let's say, an animal adoption event where you can get a hot dog or a burger or a fundraising banquet where a chicken dinner might be served. And the people that do those things, organize those events, don't necessarily or apparently see any sort of contradiction or problem with those kind of scenarios or an array of others like them. So I want to ask you for some information or statistics Food for Thought may have on how commonly this type of fare is offered at these functions, percentages, whatever you might have. But first, I want to mention two relevant experiences I had, one that put me actually on the wrong side of this equation a number of years ago. But first of all, about 13, 14 years ago, as host of this show, I was asked to MC a lunch event in South Florida held by a Greyhound organization, a Greyhound Rescue organization, and was surprised when lunch was served and it was Swiss steak. And I said something very politely afterwards, and I haven't really heard from them. I certainly haven't been invited back to host an event. So that's one thing. And kind of worse, but I think maybe more telling and representative for the conversation we want to have about food for thought. About a decade ago, I launched a big festival tied to talking animals. It was called the Talking Animals Festival, and 60 vendors and rescues and other nonprofits and a dozen bands and all kinds of stuff, including vendors and food vendors. So it was a pretty sprawling, ambitious undertaking that required a lot of delegating, including organizing the food vendors. So there was a ton of problem solving, again, as a huge first-time event. So I just paid attention to what I could and sort of delegated as many things as I could. So it was really jarring on the day of the festival to learn that one of our food vendors was serving gator tail. So super embarrassed, and the next year I micromanaged like crazy, starting with the food vendors, because that was a one-time mistake, but it was a huge mistake, especially given the nature of my show. I guess I just didn't think I needed to explain to whoever was handling that we wouldn't be serving any kind of animal. I thought that kind of went without saying, but I was wrong, and that was really, in retrospect, poor leadership on my part. So I'm only going into that much detail on this because I suspect you and your colleagues have found a number of events where similar, hopefully short-lived of mistakes were made for those kinds of reasons, and then hopefully the organizations were quite willing to embrace your policies. Does that kind of experience sound familiar to some of the folks that you've worked with over the years?
Yes. I mean, we find the organizations that we outreach to in various ways, and sometimes we will have someone reach out to us and say, I went to an event at my local shelter, a fundraising event, and they were serving meat, and it bothered me. Would you be able to reach out to this organization and offer them some information about your program? We've certainly had people reach out to us and say that they have been bothered by animal products served at a shelter or a rescue event. And so we have come across some organizations that way. I will say that often when I reach out to shelters and rescues, I find that they're already starting to make some strides to make changes. And I think that's just about the type of world that we're sort of progressing into.
Yeah.
And we found that the campaign, that it's less about pointing fingers. It's more about reaching out to these shelters and these rescue groups and just helping them connect the dots and recognize that we can't segregate farmed animals from companion animals, but we have to see them all as sentient beings. And we now have over 400 policy leaders in our campaign listed on our website as humane leaders. And I'm actually finding that more often when I reach out now, I'm getting a positive response from people. So I don't know if that's something that been on people's minds for a while, and so they're just starting to make that connection on their own, or if it's pressure from volunteers or from board members. But we're seeing a really big change now in shelters and rescues, and it's been really good to see that.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting and super encouraging, because I wondered, thinking about our conversation today, to what extent you did contact organizations that were serving meat and meat products at their events, their fundraisers, their fairs, festivals, whatever, and whether people would be responsive or would some people get defensive and say, hey, stay out of it, or just was wondering if there was an array of responses, or are most people, as you say now, pretty receptive and reasonable?
I think people are pretty receptive and reasonable. I think our society expects animal protection organizations to kind of set the bar when it comes to humane standards. And I think that people are realizing it's their responsibility as an organization to operate as compassionately as possible. And compassionately as possible means to see all animals as equal, to see a dog as a cat, as a chicken, as a cow. And I'm getting a lot of positive response in my outreach to shelter and rescue groups, which is what my focus is.
Yeah.
And I do, of course, always get a few organizations that are concerned that they're going to lose donors, they're going to upset volunteers, and that's why we're here. We're here to help with policy language. We're here to help them plan their first vegan event, and we're finding more often than not that people are really supportive and receptive to those changes.
Well, that's really great, because, like you say, I think that's part of just a much broader shift that's been going on, whereas I would guess, at least just as recently as even a few years ago, if you made those same kind of outreach calls, get more people saying, hey, well, that's just the way we do it, and kind of buzz off, as politely as they might say buzz off. So, I mean, that's really, really encouraging that, I guess maybe because of a confluence of factors, that these organizations that have been doing it this way are really either on their own or with some encouragement from Food for Thought shifting to the other way.
Right. Well, I think those feelings you had when you hosted those events, those are feelings that now others are sharing. It's a broader feeling across the spectrum where people are seeing that disconnect and recognizing it and then wanting to effectuate change. So I think now you're becoming more part of the majority than the minority.
Yeah, well, and also one of the reasons I gave that sort of blabby example was that it was an innocent thing, because I, like I said, I assume given the nature of the show and this was a first-time event that it wouldn't really need to be explained that we want to be having vegetarian or ideally strictly vegan fare, but certainly no meat product. So it was my shortcoming that I didn't, but it was totally an innocent mistake, but the upshot was still the same as the people that came that day. One of the food vendors was serving gator tail, and I thought, you know, I'm still embarrassed a decade later about it. But again, it wasn't like saying, hey, that's just the way we roll here. We serve gator tail. It was like a total huge mistake that we corrected for the next year. Tellingly or not, you know, I stopped doing the event just because it was so gigantic. It became sort of a full-time, year-long job. So it was a lesson learned thing, I guess, is my point. And I'm sure you're finding an array of reasons why people are willing to make those hardships, including that finding themselves in a situation where unintentionally they've been serving stuff that upon further inspection or thought, or just because somebody got their signals crossed in amongst the organizers.
Absolutely. And the reason why the Food for Thought campaign was created and kind of the impetus for Animal Place was that Kim herself worked at a shelter before she started the sanctuary, and a pig came into their possession that they named Zelda, and everyone doted and loved on Zelda, but then they simultaneously were holding a fundraising event where pork was served to raise money for dog kennels. And Kim immediately made that connection between raising money for dogs and rescuing dogs and placing dogs in homes, but also having Zelda and wanting to place Zelda in a home and wanting to protect and care for Zelda. So she made that connection years and years ago, and that was how Animal Place came to be, and that was eventually how Food for Thought came to fruition.
Yeah. Well, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest is Jessica Jansen, East Coast Coordinator of Animal Place's Food for Thought program, which seeks to work with various animal welfare, social justice, and environmental organizations to adopt animal and earth-friendly menu policies for their events. This interview was recorded Friday. So how does it work? You've mentioned, of course, once or twice that you either alerted by somebody else or just because you become aware of a group that may be doing things a certain way and you gently reach out to them. So that's obviously one way. Are there other ways that Food for Thought gets involved with a certain organization or a certain event?
Absolutely. We are very largely outreach-based. So a huge part of our job as campaign coordinators actually comes down to segregating states. Each coordinator has their region. And then we go through, and with the help of volunteers, we compile a list of all of the rescues, shelters, human rights groups, nonprofits, and then we outreach to them. We reach out to them and we say, hey, have you thought about aligning your menu to your values, your mission statement, and thought about hosting your first vegan event or adopting a policy? And we do most of our work through outreach. That's, I would say, 90% of what we do as campaign coordinators is outreach to different groups.
And what sort of virtues, I mean, for many they would be self-evident, but what sort of virtues do you present when speaking with these organizations that haven't yet embraced that kind of menu and hoping to persuade them to do so?
Well, I think we also point out to shelters and rescues that many people these days identify and farmed animals as companions. Rabbits, chickens, pigs, goats, other species. If these animals came into your shelter, you would certainly provide them with the same level of care that you would the more typical companion. So where do you really draw the line between friend and food? And we try to make that connection with the organization. And as I said, we do have a lot of positive response because a lot of rescues and shelters do take in farmed animals, and they do want to place them in homes, and they do love them just as much as they love the cats and the dogs in their shelters. So sometimes if we just point out that connection and we point out the work they're doing, because we know these people are compassionate. We know what they're doing for a living is out of, you know, their passion and their love for animals. So sometimes when we just make that point, they make that leap.
Yeah,
it's very simple to do, but it makes a huge statement to have that policy on your website or to at least host that first vegan event to make that attempt. So it's really just about pointing out that connection, just connecting the dots for the organization.
Right. And we should note that although this show, of course, deals with animals and animal issues primarily, and it sounds like that's your kind of specialty within Food for Thought, that as we've also kind of mentioned, at least in passing, that this also concerns social justice and environmental organizations where, again, there is obviously a disconnect of some kind if they are really not serving those kind of plant-based or vegan-friendly menus when they have earth and environmental and social justice concerns that their organization is working on.
Absolutely. Well, there's especially a connection right now with social justice groups. We point out that slaughterhouses often hire workers who are low income, people of color, undocumented, and they're forced to work long hours with little or no breaks and unsafe conditions. We've seen recently during the COVID-19 outbreak that these unsanitary, unsafe, crowded conditions were causing the workers to get sick. And then that sickness was then blamed on their minority status and their poor living conditions, when in reality it was the poor conditions that they worked in.
Yeah. And do you think, with that in mind, Jessica, that with what happened, among other things, amidst the whole COVID-19 crisis, really, that with so much of the attention that's been focused on slaughterhouses and things being shut down and distribution being limited, that this will be another factor in people coming around to a food for thought sort of philosophy?
100%. I think this is a huge point of change for us as a population. I see a lot of people speaking about plant-based meats now, making that choice to go vegan. We've seen celebrities come out in support of, you know, a vegan diet. Michelle Obama recently spoke in support of Beyond Meat. Leonardo DiCaprio has invested in Beyond Meat. We're seeing a huge change, and a lot of it is because of health reasons, because we as humans don't want to consume things that will make us ill. But then there is, you know, also the connection to the animals and the welfare of the animals. So I just think in general there is a huge turn towards a vegan movement and towards caring more about farmed animals, the conditions they live in, and what kind of lives they lead.
Yeah. And again, as part of it, it has to help in terms of messaging and people being, again, more receptive, that you can go to Burger King, you can go to KFC, you can go to White County, wherever, any number of fast food places, and get an Impossible Burger or Beyond Meat offering of some kind. And it's as simple as driving through and there's your vegan meal.
Absolutely. And when we work with organizations to host their first vegan event, we can provide them with catering links. We can provide them with organizations to go to for free food donations. We can provide them with recipes. We don't just say, hey, adopt a vegan policy or have a vegan event. We say, hey, let us lead you through this process. Let us help you host your first vegan event. Let us help you adopt that policy language. So when it comes down to actually hosting an event or adopting a policy, we're there through every stage of it.
Yeah.
And that's also the reason for the grants, is we really want to encourage people to make this compassionate choice. So we do everything we can as a campaign to aid them in that decision.
Yeah, and I think that's just crucial, because as you noted there, that you're not just calling up and saying, hey man, I heard you served burgers at your thing last Saturday. What's up with that? I mean, you're not only saying, here's how we can help you, but starting with grants. In fact, let's talk a little bit more about those grants, because that seems like a really immediately tangible entice and a demonstration of your Food for Thought's commitment to helping organizations make that transition. So how do those grants work?
So we have a couple of different grants. For an organization that might not yet be ready to take the plunge with a full policy, can start out by hosting a vegan event. And it's a one-time reimbursement of food costs for a vegan event of up to $1,000. So there is an application on our website, which is foodforthoughtcampaign.org, and you can go to event grants, and you can fill out the form, and it's based on a couple of different things. You do have to be a nonprofit. You do have to have, if you're a rescue or a shelter, you do have to have a brick-and-mortar location. You do have to be a human rights group, and you have to consistently host events, because it is an event grant.
Yeah.
And so you fill out that application, it gets reviewed, and then if you're approved, once you host your grant, you send us those receipts, and we reimburse you up to $1,000. For the policy grant, that's when you adopt a menu policy. That's when you create language, put that on your website, have your board vote on that, and then you move forward saying, we will never serve animal product at any of our events. And then we can give you a one-time gift of $1,000 for implementing that vegan menu policy.
And so, Jessica, for the first one, the event grant, is there a specific criteria that helps determine, like, why an organization would be approved and why maybe the next one wouldn't be approved?
Yeah, so if you're a nonprofit and you fill out an application and you don't have a brick-and-mortar location, it's not 100% that you'll be denied, but we do try, me as a shelter coordinator, I do try to give preference to those that have brick-and-mortar locations. You have to be a nonprofit 100%, and especially for a vegan event grant, we'd like to see that you consistently host events. So we know that you're going to be able to host an event and then make that compassionate choice to have that event be vegan. So a large portion of it is, of course, being a nonprofit.
Yeah.
for the work that I do for rescues and sanctuaries. It's having a physical shelter, and it's consistently hosting events.
And so how many in a given year would you say, how many applications for event grants would you typically receive?
You know, that would be hard for me to say. I'm not exactly sure. I would say we do get a couple a month, and we do approve quite a few. So the chances of getting a grant are great if you meet those requirements. Mm-hmm. And we certainly encourage people, if you're thinking about having a vegan event for the first time or you're thinking about adopting a policy, please reach out. Please fill out the application. Please contact us. You know, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. So
right.
I certainly encourage all organizations that are nonprofit and think that they meet the requirements to fill something out and to contact us. We would love to work with them.
Right. And I would guess from the way you're describing how this works, that let's say our organization did apply for an event grant and maybe for one reason or another wasn't approved, that I assume that wouldn't preclude them reapplying the next year or after a certain reasonable amount of time, and maybe that time they would be approved.
Absolutely, absolutely. And right now we're telling organizations, I know that we're in a place where we're not hosting a lot of events, but certainly if you have one in mind for the future, that's a great time to think about having a vegan event and filling out a grant application. And if for some reason you're unable to host events currently, there's always a policy grant. You do not have to be planning an event currently to apply for a policy grant. You just have to be an organization that has hosted events in the past and will host events in the future.
And is ready to articulate that policy on your website and social media.
Absolutely. The policy language is important. It is a statement that you have to make. It's really simple to do. We can provide examples of policy language, but it's just about making the statement that you will not serve animal products at your future events.
Right. Again, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'm speaking with Jessica Jansen of Food for Thought, which seeks to work with various animal welfare, social justice, and environmental organizations to adopt animal and earth-friendly menu policies for their events. This conversation was recorded Friday. So in a moment or two, I'm going to ask you maybe about some menus, what those might look like for some of these events that Food for Thought would propose. But before we get to that, aside from applying for these grants, what are some other suggestions or guidance that Food for Thought offers to organizations that are making that transition or seeking to?
Well, we have some different opportunities on our website to get some information. We have a lot of different links to different kinds of food companies that can provide samples of food or what you can buy if you're going to be cooking yourself. We have recipes. We also have links to vegan caterers. We certainly do try to help our organizations through every step of hosting an event. We love to receive pictures back when the event is complete so we can put that on our website so that you can show other organizations not only how easy it can be, but how successful it can be in the end. So we certainly have a lot of information about hosting a vegan event. And we also have plenty of policy language examples for people to take a look at. When I reach out to organizations and they express an interest in adopting a policy, I usually send some sample language to help them along. Then they can create something really very simple. It doesn't have to be elaborate. It just has to state that you won't be serving animal products at your event. And then if you have a board, it would be great to have them vote on that. And if you don't have a board, then you can just put that on your website and become a policy leader and lead by example.
Yeah, well, that's the thing that I find among the things that are so wonderful about Food for Thought is that for a lot of organizations, especially maybe based on the size of the organization and or the size of the events that they typically organize, it could seem really daunting to make this kind of transition. But with the information that you guys provide, the suggestions, the potential for grants and ideas about food companies that might step up and help out with some samples. And I mean, there's so many things that a lot of people that are organizing these events would say, oh, what about this? What about this? What about this? And the answers are there, and there's a template for stuff, and there's ways that you can really simplify that transition so that your mission or apparent mission is more directly aligned with what you're doing at these events and fundraisers and adoption events, etc.
Absolutely. I mean, we try to make it as simple as possible. And like I tell organizations, it really is simple to do. It really is a simple step to make to make a more humane statement for your organization. And it does. It makes a huge statement with over 400 policy leaders currently supporting the campaign. We have made a lot of progress, and they're great examples for the rest of the profession.
Yeah. All right. So this might be the best part of the whole shebang in some ways. Let's talk about some menus that Food for Thought would propose for an event of one kind or another. Spoiler alert, some samples of this kind are presented on Food for Thought's website, which again is Food for Thought.
Yeah, absolutely. We love hearing back from the organizations that have hosted vegan events. We love hearing about the menus they've chosen. We've seen some really exciting things from cauliflower barbecue to people grilling out Beyond Burgers. Limitless options, truly. And we love receiving the photos. We love feedback from the different organizations about what worked for them. We've seen a lot of organizations bring in really great vegan food trucks. I mean, nowadays, you know, you're just not limited to a salad. There are so many options. The summer is here. You can do vegan jackfruit barbecue. You can do vegan mac and cheese. There's so much that you can do with a vegan event. And we get excited when we hear back from organizations about the things they've tried.
Yeah, no doubt. And again, those menus that you kind of sample menus that you have posted, again, on foodforthoughtcampaign.org, they're by different kinds of events. So there might be a reception here and a full-blown banquet there and whatever. But I thought, oh my God, I mean, you know, when I looked at those, I got super hungry. It's like, hey.
Yeah, they're really enticing. And we get such positive feedback from how the guests felt when they were there and how much they enjoyed it. So it's one of the joys of working in the campaign is seeing a successful event. And yeah, they're almost always successful. And we're really, really excited to see that as part of the campaign.
Yeah. Well, one thing that's clear from our conversation, Jessica, is that you and your colleagues at Food for Thought really want to make it easy for organizations to embrace this kind of transition. So I'd be interested to know, like, what a typical day for you is like. So obviously one thing that happened today was this interview, but otherwise, are you fielding calls from organizations that are saying, hey, we think we want to make this transition, but we need some guidance, we need your expertise? I mean, walk us through some of the key things that would happen on any given day at your desk.
Well, we all work from home, which is super convenient during the current pandemic, but yeah, we've always worked from home. And a lot of our work is via phone or email. Mm-hmm. A huge part of my day is outreach to various shelters and rescues, asking them if they host events and if they've thought about having a vegan event or adopting a vegan policy. And then it's the back and forth emails and follow-ups. It's a lot of phone calls. We have social media accounts that we all manage. We have PR opportunities such as this one. So it's 100% outreach all the time.
Yeah.
It really is. It's us outreaching to groups and then facilitating their needs. So it's a really enjoyable job. I love working with these different nonprofits. I love seeing them effectuate positive change for animals. And we as a campaign team work really well together. It's a great job to have. It's a lot of fun. And it's an honor and a joy working for Animal Place.
And I'm sure it also is really exciting to see more and more the actual results, like probably percentage-wise, given some years ago to now, the organizations that are indeed embracing those new menus and that new kind of philosophy about events is probably much larger than, I don't know how long you've been doing this this particular kind of work, but I would think that there's been a significant surge in the number of organizations that say, yeah, this is how we should be doing our events from now on.
Absolutely. The Food for Thought campaign was established in 2013, but we've grown exponentially. We've grown in size as a team. We've grown in the number of policy leaders we've had. We're now growing to accept social justice organizations into our fold. We're working with environmental and wildlife organizations. So the campaign's growth has been exponential, and the impact has been huge. So it's very exciting to see. It's a very exciting time for us.
No, that's great. And it's such great work because, again, really makes a huge difference for everybody, animal, human animal, whoever you are, as more and more organizations do embrace this sort of approach to presenting events. So that's great. So we've been speaking with Jessica Jansen, again, East Coast Coordinator for Animal Place's Food for Thought program. The website, one more time, is foodforthoughtcampaign.org. Animal Place's website is animalplace.org, and of course their social media track down either or both. So Jessica, thank you so much for making the time to outline all this and give us the scoop on what's, I think, a great, great program in so many ways. Thanks again.
Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it, and I love sharing the campaign with all your listeners.
All right. Thanks, Jessica. In a moment, I'll play back my conversation with Dara Eckhart, CEO of St. Pete's Friends of Strays, discussing some changes in the shelter she's helped shepherd and what may be around the corner, among other topics. Right now, though, we're going to step into the Comedy Corner. This is a piece by John Mulaney called Baby Grandma in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
My wife and I don't have any children. We have a dog. We have a little puppy named Petunia. She's a tiny little French bulldog puppy. I like having a puppy that's a bulldog because it's like having a baby that is also a grandma. Her body is young, her face is as old as time. She definitely saw the Nazis march into Paris. She always gives me this look of like, oh, the things I have seen. You have no idea. The Gestapo threw my printing press into a river. But go tell your jokes. Bring me my dish. She said that. Petunia is my best friend in the world. I give her a million kisses a day. She does not like me and barks at me and bites me all day long. We had to get a dog trainer into the apartment because Petunia is a bad dog. We tell her that every day. We go, hey, you're bad at being a dog. So the trainer came into the apartment. Sorry, didn't even walk into the apartment. Walked into the threshold and went, oh, okay. Like she was an exorcist or something. She said, I see what the problem is. She said, Petunia has become the alpha of the house. And then she pointed at me. She said, you are no longer the alpha of the house. And in the back of my head, I was like, I was never the alpha of the house. I turned to my wife. I was like, let's pretend. It'll be fun. Yes, my title of alpha, which I once had. How could I reclaim it? Because that was a thing that existed at one time. She said, you need to show dominance over your puppy. These are things people say to me. I said, how do I do that? She said, well, let me ask you this. Who eats dinner first, you or Petunia? I was like, Petunia eats dinner first. She eats dinner at 5 p.m. because she's a foot long and 2 years old. She said, no, you need to eat dinner first because the king eats before anyone else eats. Oh, yes. And what a mighty king I will be. Eating dinner at 4:45 in the afternoon. Ah, ha, ha, ha! Look upon your sovereign, Petunia, and tremble. My lands stretch across this entire one bedroom, and I eat dinner whenever I choose, as long as it works for the schedule of a dog. She said, no, you don't actually have to eat dinner before Petunia. You just have to convince Petunia that you've already eaten. So, for the past month, before my wife and I give Petunia her dish, we take down empty bowls and spoons, and in front of her, we go, dinner. Good dinner. Like we're space aliens in a play about human beings that they wrote, but they didn't work that hard on. We're eating dinner. Meanwhile, Petunia's just staring at us with her Paul Giamatti face, like, you're not eating dinner. Dish now.
That was John Mulaney with a piece called Baby Grandma, taken from his album, The Comeback Kid. Now it's time to hear my conversation with Dara Eckhart, CEO of Friends of Strays in St. Petersburg, recorded Friday. This is Dara Eckhart on Talking Animals on WMNF. thanks for joining us on the show this morning, Dara.
Thanks for having me, Duncan.
Even though Friends of Strays has been around a lot longer than many other shelters or other organizations, for that matter, in the Tampa Bay area, I still think it might be helpful if we were to start by asking you to give us a brief overview. What is Friends of Strays? When was it established? And what is its mission?
So Friends of Strays was established in 1978, so we're in our 42nd year of operation. We were really started as a rescue. Jean Vermonti and her friends used to drive around St. Pete and on their bikes, actually, and they would pick up stray cats and take them back to their houses, kind of get them back to health and try and get them adopted out. And eventually they got to a point where they decided to create a 501c3. We were really the first no-kill shelter established in St. Petersburg, and that's really been our mission ever since, is to help the homeless and abandoned animals in St. Pete and give them a place to live until we're able to find their forever home without the risk of euthanasia.
So 40 plus years is a lot of history and probably a lot of change. I guess my first question in terms of what may have changed, are there still people out on bikes scooping up the strays?
Well, you know, St. Pete is a very bike-friendly city, but
right.
I'm not sure how many people are scooping them up. We do get a lot of stray cats, and that right now is actually kitten season.
Right.
And we are experiencing, you know, an inundation in really small kittens, neonatal kittens. So there's not a day that goes by that we don't get a couple of litters in right now.
Sure. So even though you clearly haven't been at Friends of Strays the whole time, so really not in a position to personally witness other important evolutions away from maybe some of the bike work or whatever. Still, what do you understand are the biggest changes that Friends of Strays have experienced over those four decades in terms of just the way it's worked, the way it's structured, any evolution of the mission, et cetera?
I think the mission's been pretty steady over the 42 years, but lots of other things have changed. I know a lot of people are familiar with our thrift shop that we had out on 19 and Gandy, and it's actually, we're closing on that property today, selling it to a developer. That was actually gifted to us back in the 80s, and it's really going to allow us to expand our mission even more over the next decade or so as we look to expand our facility and also expand programming within the community to help our community partners and just people that really need our assistance right now. So there's been a ton of changes. A lot has really happened under my leadership. I've been here for about 3.5 years now, and we and my leadership team have really turned the place around. I know when I first started, we didn't have the best reputation in town, and we really, you know, made a significant effort to change that.
Dara, sorry to interrupt, but what was that reputation that maybe wasn't so illustrious when you came in, and then what were the things you did to kind of help recalibrate that?
Sure. Well, I think we didn't have really good leadership for a long period of time. And unfortunately, the shelter was crowded. I know when I first came in for my interview and did a walkthrough of the shelter, there were like 238 cats in the shelter.
Oh, my goodness.
And a facility that shouldn't have more than, you know, 50 or 60.
Wow.
So we had, you know, cats that were unhealthy. They were stacked in rooms, not able to get out of their cages, really, really tiny cages that they were in. And, you know, they don't show well, so they don't get adopted quickly. We had cats that were living there for like 8 years at a time.
Oh, wow.
And that was just something that, you know, I strongly believe when I came in, yeah, animals don't belong in a shelter. Our job is to get them out into homes.
Sure.
So we really started working with the staff to help them understand how important it is to really engage with people when they come in and give them the best experience ever. We made some, you know, renovations to the shelter to make it more welcoming and to make it function better. And just over the last couple of years, we've really gained a foothold in the community as St. Pete's shelter of choice.
Well, it seems like on the one hand, you'd want to make it more welcoming in some ways. And of course, to some of those cats that have been there 6, 7, 8 years, it's like, okay, time to move on, pal. Let's get you adopted
right,
out today.
Right.
So, okay, so you've been there 3.5 years. So let's fast forward a little bit to 2020. Tell me things that have been like Friends of Strays first before the pandemic hit. And then, of course, we'll talk a little bit about the Friends of Strays version during the COVID-19 era.
Yeah, so, you know, 2020 started. We had our best adoption year ever last year. We adopted out over 1,200 animals, going from, I think it was like 540 the first year that I was there. So we've well more than doubled the number of animals that are getting adopted each year. everything was, you know, going smoothly. We had plans in place to start looking at expanding our facility. And then COVID hit, and we quickly had to regroup and pivot. And I think pivot's the word of the year for most organizations right now. But really, what we wanted to do was try and figure out how we could best impact our community. So many things have changed in animal sheltering over the last couple of months, and shelters across the nation are empty right now.
Right.
There was a huge call for fosters, as you know, when the pandemic hit, and most of the shelters were successful in emptying the shelters, but now we're all kind of at a loss. Like, what do you do as an animal shelter if you don't have animals in your facility? So we really shifted our focus to how we can best impact our community. And one of the things we came up with was the Safer at Home Fund. So we know a lot of people in St. Petersburg in particular have lost their jobs due to COVID. A lot of people in the service industry, restaurants, bars, are really struggling right now to afford basic necessities. So we created this fund and did a fundraising campaign on Giving Tuesday now at the beginning of the month and raised $26,000, which is going to go towards providing vouchers to people who have lost their jobs due to COVID. So they can buy dog food, cat litter, flea treatment. And then we partnered also with a couple of clinics that will do free spay and neuter, and vaccinations, basic vaccinations. So we're really trying to help keep animals out of the shelter going forward.
Yeah, because that was a question I was going to ask when you were talking about the sweeping number of adoptions that have happened during the COVID-19 period. And I know there's some concerns among some of your counterparts with the economic impact that you also mentioned of people losing their jobs or at least some economic impact. Will some of those animals come back? I mean, short of the kind of program that you've devised, but otherwise things are getting difficult for a lot of people, and they may just feel like not necessarily feeding that cat or dog, but like as vet bills come up or other things, like, mm-hmm. Hey, maybe we were a little too hasty adopting that dog or cat when we were all kind of sheltering at home. What kind of concerns do you have in that way?
Well, some of the concerns that I've had with dogs being adopted in particular right now is with people working from home, you have this brand new dog that came in to your house, and all they know is you being here all day. And as soon as you start going back to work and life gets back to normal, it's going to be anything but normal for that dog.
Sure.
So you're likely going to have some behavior issues. Separation anxiety is huge for dogs, unfortunately, and they can, you know, be destructive in the house. So now is really a good time for people to start looking into training, how they can start kind of breaking away from that dog, going out, you know, a few hours a day, and just getting it used to you not being there all the time. So that's one of my concerns, that there's going to be some behavioral issues that people notice, and they're not going to be able to take care of it when life gets back to normal.
Yeah.
And we're going to see some return.
Right. So you're just sort of braced for a certain number of those almost being, if not inevitable, quite likely.
Yeah, I would say a good portion of people might be struggling after they get back to a normal life.
Yeah. And meanwhile, as far as still, I think, was a great surge in adoptions, how will that likely influence kitten season that you mentioned earlier?
So we have actually been pretty steady with adoptions. We started doing adoptions by appointment a couple of weeks ago. And but I think we're going to be opening that up to just a regular shelter hours next week, probably. But people are still ready to adopt. I mean, we've got people calling every day looking for cats, dogs, kittens, puppies, anything, you know, the whole spectrum. So I feel like as long as we have animals, we're going to be able to find homes for them. You know, it's just a matter of waiting around, I think, for what we think is going to happen with an influx of owner surrenders at some point.
I gotcha. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm speaking with Dara Eckhart, CEO of Friends of Strays in St. Petersburg, and this interview was recorded Friday. We're just probably in our last few minutes here, Dara, but I know another thing that I guess about a couple weeks ago or thereabouts, Friends of Strays formed an alliance with Home to Home. What is that and how does that work?
This is a really great program that was developed by another shelter, and basically it's a way for people to rehome their animals without putting them in a shelter environment. So what we're looking at right now is trying to impact shelter diversion or intake diversion. So any way that we can keep animals out of the shelter right now is what we're going to work towards. So this home-to-home website, basically, it's a link from our website. People can post their dogs or cats. Absolutely no fees or no funds can change hands. So they're going to be free adoptions. But it's just a way to help people feel more comfortable about rehoming their animals instead of just putting them on Craigslist and hoping for the best, or, you know, having to take them to a shelter that might not have the great track record with being a no-kill shelter. So we really are excited about this and think that it's going to be a huge benefit to people in our community to help them rehome their animals.
And is there a criteria of sorts for what kind of animals or what the situation for someone to put their animals into the home-to-home sort of postings? In other words, I guess one concern, I guess, that it would be obvious that seems like a lot of people are all too comfortable giving up their animals in some cases when they're, let's say, they're moving or, God forbid, their dog is getting older. I mean, you hear these heartbreaking stories a lot of the time. So I don't know if there's a way to screen for that, or if you kind of say, hey, I'm not crazy about your reason, but I'd still rather help this animal, even though I think you're maybe not the greatest person. I mean, how does that work in terms of the home-to-home initiative?
You know, I think the second part of what you said is really where we're at with this. So we don't want to judge people. There are many, many reasons why someone has to make a difficult decision like this.
Sure.
And granted, there are some people that don't take it seriously and don't think of a pet as family. And I have a hard time not judging people like that, but we're not here to judge.
Yeah.
We're here to help the animals.
That's my job, Dara. It's my job to judge them, as you could tell by my question. Sorry, but go ahead.
You judge for me, and
okay,
we'll be good.
That's right. Okay, I'll handle the judging. Okay, so that's good. So whatever the person's reason or reasons that they say, you know what, I just, and again, circling back to the impact of COVID and how huge the financial impact that has been on so many people and other reasons, good or maybe not so good, everybody's kind of eligible to get help with rehoming their animal when they feel like it's time.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's
yeah,
great.
That's what we really want to be, is just a resource for the community. Nobody wants to make that decision, and if we can help in any way to either keep that animal at home or get them into a better home without putting them in the shelter environment, that's what we really want to do right now.
So just in our final moment or so here, what else? Obviously, the hope is that at some point the COVID-19 thing will be better. I mean, I don't know if we'll ever completely shake off the impact.
Yeah.
But when some of the precautions and limitations and stuff have lifted, what else is kind of new or the planning stage at Friends of Strays, or just sort of on the horizon for when you can function more readily without those kind of restrictions that we've all been living under?
Sure. Well, as I mentioned earlier, we've been looking at expanding our facility right now. We're in this tiny little shelter in Joe's Creek Industrial Park, and there's no parking whatsoever.
Yeah.
And, you know, we could really have a bigger impact on the community if we could have better space to like, you know, community education events and just house more animals if we need to. Of course, the goal is to, you know, keep more of them in foster homes or not let them in the shelter in the first place. But we really feel like there's going to be a greater need for a greater facility in St. Petersburg in particular. So that's something that we're looking at in the next couple of years. We've been very lucky to have received a huge bequest from one of our very favorite supporters who passed away last year, unfortunately. Mm. And so we're setting that money aside and being very cautious and just kind of taking our time to find the right property and figure out where we want to be in the next couple of years to better impact the community.
Sure. And you mentioned earlier in our conversation that just today, as we're recording this on Friday, at least today, that you're closing on the thrift shop. Does that mean that will there be another thrift shop at another location, or is that closing up the era of the Friends of Strays thrift shop as well?
That is definitely putting the nail in the coffin for the thrift shop era.
Okay. I gotcha.
I think it was helpful at the beginning, and certainly the donation of the building to us is going to have a huge impact for years to come. But running a thrift shop is not really supporting our mission. The way it was run before we closed it down just wasn't efficient, and we weren't getting the money that we needed for operational support. So we really wanted to focus our efforts more on taking care of the animals.
I got you.
And so thrift shops are that's not the future for us, for sure.
Gotcha. Okay, well, thanks so much. We've been speaking with Dara Eckhart, CEO of Friends of Strays. The website is friendsofstrays.com. I'm always a little nervous when I say that because the email addresses are .org, if I'm not mistaken, but the website is friendsofstrays.com.
Well, we actually switched our website to .org.
Oh, okay,
year.
So I still... still got it wrong. I was being so careful in explaining my caution, and I got it wrong anyway. Okay, so it's friendsofstrays.org. And, of course, they're on social media as well, and there's all kinds of cool animals you can take a look at that are available for adoption as we speak. So, Dara, thanks so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals, and thanks for all your good work.
Thanks so much, Duncan, and thank you for all you do to bring awareness to animal issues.
I appreciate it. Thanks. I'm Duncan Strauss, and you're listening to Talking Animals. Coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Loride with Radioactivity. Meanwhile, on this show, at the moment, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a Talking Animals t-shirt. As a reminder, would you name that animal tune differently these days? Rather than call, if you know the tune, please email me at duncan@wmnf.org with your guess of the song title. Again, a Talking Animals t-shirt to the first person who emails duncan@wmnf.org and correctly identifies this animal song. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals on WMNF. Animal tune? We've reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. I invite you to return next Wednesday at 10 a.m. for another edition of the show. I also invite you to visit talkinganimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast, links to all our social media, and more. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Stay tuned for Rob Loride. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond.